listening to the outside. I had no unreasonable fear of bats, knowing them for timid little creatures, yet I knew them too for carriers of the dread hydrophobia, for which there was no specific. What would the bats do, come night and their time to fly, and they found their opening to the outer world closed off? Would they bite? If I struggled and kicked against them, I would surely shake myself through the hole, but I knew I had not the will to remain motionless and let them bite. Night. Was I to be here then till night? I must keep my head and guard against such thoughts. What of Labeef? And what had become of Rooster Cogburn? He had not appeared to be badly hurt in the fall of his horse, but how would he know I was down here? I did not like my situation. I thought to set fire to bits of cloth for a signal of smoke, but the idea was useless because I had no matches. Surely someone would come, perhaps Captain Finch. The news of the gunfight must get out and bring a party to investigate. Yes, the posse of marshals. The thing was to hold tight. Help was sure to come. At least there were no snakes. I settled on this course. I would give cries for help every 5 minutes, or as near on that interval as I could guess it to be. I called out at once, and was again mocked by the echo of my own voice, and by the wind, and the dripping of the cave water, and the squeaking of the bats. I told numbers to measure the time. It occupied my mind and gave me a sense of purpose and method. I had not counted far when my body slipped down appreciably, and with panic in my breast, I realized that the moss which gripped me in a tight seal was tearing loose. I looked about for something to hold to, broken arm or not, but my hand found only slick and featureless planes of rock I was going through. It was a matter now of time. Another lurch down to the level of my right elbow. That bony knob served as a momentary check, but I could feel the moss giving way against it. A wedge, that was what I needed, something to stuff in the hole with me to make the cork fit more snugly, or a long stick to pass under my arm. I cast my eyes about for something suitable. The few sticks lying about were none of them long enough or stout enough for my purpose. If only I could reach the blue shirt. It would be just the thing for packing. I broke one stick, scratching and pulling at the shirt tail. With the second one, I managed to bring it within reach of my fingertips. Weakened as my hand was, I got a purchase on the cloth with thumb and finger and pulled it out of the dark. It was unexpectedly heavy. Something was attached to it. Suddenly I jerked my hand away as though from a hot stove. The something was the corpse of a man, or, more properly, a skeleton. He was wearing the shirt. I did nothing for a minute, so frightful and astonishing was the discovery. I could see a good part of the remains, the head with patches of bright orange hair showing under a piece of rotted black hat, one shirt-sleeved arm, and that portion of the trunk from about the waist upwards. The shirt was buttoned in two or three places near the neck. I soon recovered my wits. I am falling. I need that shirt. These thoughts bore upon me with urgency. I had no stomach for the task ahead, but there was nothing else to be done in my desperate circumstances. My plan was to give the shirt a smart jerk in hopes of tearing it free from the skeleton. I will have that shirt. Thus I took hold of the garment again and snatched it toward me with such sharp force as I could muster. My arm seized up with a stab of pain, and I let go. After a little tingling, the pain subsided and gave way to a dull and tolerable ache. I examined the result of my effort. The buttons had torn free, and now the body was within reach. The shirt itself remained clothed about the shoulders and arm bones in a careless fashion. I saw, too, that the maneuver had exposed the poor man's rib cage. One more pull, and I would have the body close enough so that I could work the shirt free. As I made ready for the job, my eyes were attracted to something. Movement? Within the cavity formed by the curving gray ribs. I leaned over for a closer look. Snakes. A ball of snakes. I flung myself back, but of course there was no real retreat for me, imprisoned as I was in the mossy trap. I cannot accurately guess the number of rattlesnakes in the ball, as some were bigger than my arm, and others small, ranging down to the size of lead pencils, but I believe there were not fewer than 40. With trembling heart, I looked on as they writhed sluggishly about in the man's chest. I had disturbed their sleep in their curious winter quarters, and now, more or less conscious, they had begun to move and detach themselves from the tangle, falling this way and that. This, thought I, is a pretty fix. I desperately needed the shirt, but I did not wish to mess further with the snakes in order to have it. Even while I considered these things, I was settling and being drawn down to what? Perhaps a black and bottomless pool of water where the fish were white and had no eyes to see. I wondered if the snakes could bite in their present lethargic state. I thought they could not see well, if at all, but I observed, too, that the light and warmth of the sun had an invigorating effect on them. We kept two speckled king snakes in our corn crib to eat rats, and I was not afraid of them, Saul and little David, but I really knew nothing about snakes. Moccasins and rattlers were to be avoided if possible, and killed if there was a chopping hoe handy. That was all I knew about poisonous snakes. The ache in my broken arm grew worse. I felt some more of the binding moss give way against my right arm, and at the same time I saw that some of the snakes were crawling out through the man's ribs. Lord, help me! I set my teeth and took hold of the bony hand that stuck forth from the blue shirt sleeve. I gave a yank and pulled the man's arm clean away from the shoulder. A terrible thing to do, you say, but you will see that I now had something to work with. I studied the arm. Bits of cartilage held it together at the elbow joint. With some twisting, I managed to separate it at that place. I took the long bone of the upper arm and secured it under my armpit to serve as a cross member. This would keep me from plunging through the hole should I reach that point in my descent. It was quite a long bone, and, I hoped, a strong one. I was grateful to the poor man for being tall. What I had left now was the lower part, the two bones of the forearm and the hand and wrist, all of a piece. I grasped it at the elbow and proceeded to use it as a flail to keep the snakes at bay. "Here, get away," said I, slapping at them with the bony hand. "Get back, you." This was well enough, except that I perceived the agitation only caused them to be more active. In trying to keep them away, I was at the same time stirring them up. They moved very slowly, but there were so many I could not keep track of them all. Each blow I struck brought burning pain to my arm, and you can imagine these blows were not hard enough to kill the snakes. That was not my idea. My idea was to keep them back and prevent them from getting behind me. My striking range from left to right was something short of 180 degrees, and I knew if the rattlers got behind me, I would be in a fine pickle. I heard noises above. A shower of sand and pebbles came cascading down. "Help!" I cried out. "I am down here. I need help." My thought was, "Thank God. Someone has come. Soon I will be out of this hellish place." I saw drops of something spattering on a rock in front of me. It was blood. "Hurry up!" I yelled. "There are snakes and skeletons down here." A man's voice called down, saying, "I warrant there'll be another one before spring. A little spindly one." It was the voice of Tom Chaney. I had not yet made a good job of killing him. I supposed he was leaning over the edge and the blood was falling from his wounded head. "How do you like it?" he taunted. "Throw me a rope, Tom. You cannot be mean enough to leave me."
"You say you don't like it?"
Then I heard a shout and the sounds of a scuffle and a dreadful crunch, which was Rooster Cogburn's rifle stock smashing the wounded head of Tom Chaney. There followed a furious rush of rocks and dust. The light was blocked off, and I made out a large object hurtling down toward me. It was the body of Tom Chaney. I leaned back as far as I could to avoid being struck, and at that it was a near thing. He fell directly upon the skeleton, crushing the bones and filling my face and eyes with dirt and scattering the puzzled rattlesnakes every which way. They were all about me, and I commenced striking at them with such abandon that my body dropped free through the hole. Gone. No. Checked short. I was shakily suspended in space by the bone under my armpit. Bats flew up past my face, and the ones below were carrying on like a treeful of sparrows at sundown. Only my head and my left arm and shoulder now remained above the hole. I hung at an uncomfortable angle. The bone was bowed under my weight, and I prayed it would hold. My left arm was cramped and fully occupied in holding to it, and I had not the use of the hand in fending off the snakes. "Help!" I called. "I need help!" Rooster's voice came booming down, saying,
"Are you all right?"
"No, I am in a bad way. Hurry up."
"I am pitching down a rope. Fasten it under your arms and tie it with a good knot."
"I cannot manage a rope. You will have to come down and help me. Hurry up, I am falling. There are snakes all about my head."
"Hold on, hold on," came another voice. It was LaBeef. The Texan had survived the blow. The officers were both safe. I watched as two rattlers struck and sunk their sharp teeth into Tom Chaney's face and neck. The body was lifeless and made no protest. My thought was, those scoundrels can bite in December, and right there is the proof of it. One of the smaller snakes approached my hand and rubbed his nose against it. I moved my hand a little, and the snake moved to it and touched his nose to the flesh again. He moved a bit more and commenced to rub the underside of his jaw on top of my hand. From the corner of my eye, I saw another snake on my left shoulder. He was motionless and limp. I could not tell if he was dead or merely asleep. Whatever the case, I did not want him there, and I began to swing my body gently from side to side on the bone axle. The movement caused the serpent to roll over with his white belly up, and I gave my shoulder a shake, and he fell into the darkness below. I felt a sting, and I saw the little snake pulling his head away from my hand, an amber drop of venom on his mouth. He had bitten me. The hand was already well along to being dead numb from the cramped position, and I hardly felt it. It was on the order of a horsefly bite. I counted myself lucky the snake was small. That was how much I knew of natural history. People who know tell me the younger snakes carry the more potent poison, and that it weakens with age. I believe what they say. Now here came Rooster with a rope looped around his waist and his feet against the sides of the pit, descending in great violent leaps and sending another shower of rocks and dust down on me. He landed with a heavy bump, and then it seemed he was doing everything at once. He grasped the collar of my coat and shirt behind my neck and heaved me up from the hole with one hand, at the same time kicking at snakes and shooting at them with his belt revolver. The noise was deafening and made my head ache. My legs were wobbly. I could hardly stand. Rooster said,
"Can you hold to my neck?"
I said, "Yes, I will try." There were two dark red holes in his face with dried rivulets of blood under them where shotgun pellets had struck him. He stooped down, and I wrapped my right arm around his neck and lay against his back. He tried to climb the rope, hand over hand, with his feet against the sides of the pit, but he made only about three pulls and had to drop back down. Our combined weight was too much for him. His right shoulder was torn from a bullet, too, although I did not know it at the time. "Stay behind me," he said, kicking and stomping the snakes while he reloaded his pistol. A big grandfather snake coiled himself around Rooster's boot and got his head shot off for his boldness. Rooster said,
Do you think you can climb the rope?
My arm is broken, said I, and I am bit on the hand. He looked at the hand and pulled his dirk knife and cut the place to scarify it. He squeezed blood from it and took some smoking tobacco and hurriedly chewed it into a cud and rubbed it over the wound to draw the poison. Then he harnessed the rope tightly under my arms. He shouted up to the Texan, saying,
Take the rope, LaBeef. Maddie is hurt. I want you to pull her up in easy stages. Can you hear me?
LaBeef replied,
I will do what I can.
The rope grew taut and lifted me to my toes.
Pull, shouted Rooster. The girl is snake-bit, man, pull.
But LaBeef could not do it, weakened as he was by his bad arm and broken head.
It's no use, he said. I will try the horse.
In a matter of minutes, he had fastened the rope to a pony.
I am ready, the Texan called down to us. Take a good hold.
Go, said Rooster.
He had looped the rope about his hips and once around his waist. He held me with the other arm. We were jerked from our feet. Now there was power at the other end. We went up in bounds. Rooster worked to keep us clear of the rough sides with his feet. We were skinned up a little. Sunlight and blue sky. I was so weak that I lay upon the ground and could not speak. I blinked my eyes to accommodate them to the brightness, and I saw that LaBeef was sitting with his bloody head in his hands and gasping from his labors and driving the horse. Then I saw the horse. It was Little Blackie. The scrub pony had saved us. My thought was, the stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner. Rooster tied the cud of tobacco on top of my hand with a rag. He said,
Can you walk?
Yes, I think so, said I. He led me toward the horse, and when I had walked a few steps, I was overcome with nausea, and I dropped to my knees. When the sickness had passed, Rooster helped me along and placed me in the saddle astride Little Blackie. He bound my feet to the stirrups, and with another length of rope, he tied my waist to the saddle, front and back. Then he mounted behind me. He said to LaBeef,
I will send help as soon as I can. Don't wander off.
I said, We are not leaving him.
Rooster said, I must get you to a doctor, sis, or you are not going to make it. He said to LaBeef as an afterthought, I am in your debt for that shot, pard. The Texan said nothing, and we left him there holding his head. I expect he was feeling pretty bad. Rooster spurred Blackie away, and the faithful pony stumbled and skidded down the steep and brushy hill where prudent horsemen led their mounts. The descent was dangerous, and particularly so with such a heavy burden as Blackie was carrying. There was no way to dodge all the limbs. Rooster lost his hat and never looked back. We galloped across the meadow where the smoky duel had lately occurred. My eyes were congested from nausea, and through a tearful haze I saw the dead horses and the bodies of the bandits. The pain in my arm became intense, and I commenced to cry, and the tears were blown back in streams around my cheeks. Once down from the mountains, we headed north, and I guessed we were aiming for Fort Smith.
Despite the load, Blackie held his head high and ran like the wind, perhaps sensing the urgency of the mission. Rooster spurred and whipped him without let. I soon passed away in a faint. When I regained my senses, I realized we had slowed. Heaving and choking for breath, Blackie was yet giving us all he had. I cannot say how many miles we had ridden full out. Poor lathered beast. Rooster whipped and whipped. Stop, I said. We must stop. He is played out. Rooster paid me no heed. Blackie was all in, and as he stumbled and made to stop, Rooster took his dirk knife and cut a brutal slash on the pony's withers. Stop it, I cried. Little Blackie squealed and burst forth in a run under the stimulation of the pain. I wrestled for the reins, but Rooster slapped my hands away. I was crying and yelling. When Blackie slowed again, Rooster took salt from his pocket and rubbed the wound with it, and the pony leaped forward as before. In a very few minutes, this torture was mercifully ended. Blackie fell to the ground and died. His brave heart burst